Hey there, and welcome to the Smart and Simple Matters show with your host, Joel Zaslavsky. Very rarely does something go well the first time. But this time, we're about to flip that script. This is episode number 57. Thank you so much for joining me today and giving me your time and attention. I do not ever take it for granted, so I am really grateful that you're with me right now. First up, I got to give a shout out to Miriam, who recently left this iTunes review of the show. She wrote, "As always, Joel leaks enthusiasm all over my morning and helps the guests get right to the heart of the matter. There is such a close connection between clutter and simplifying. I appreciate that Joel continues to explore the possibilities, even when stuck in spreadsheet land." End of review. Well, Miriam, I'm glad that I'm leaking my enthusiasm all over you instead of my leaky brain. Ew, that would be kind of gross, wouldn't it? And I got to tell you, I will always be stuck in spreadsheet land, but it's good to know that I can add value even to people who don't drool over an empty Excel tab like I do. Ooh, Excel, I love you. All right, here's a little bit about what's been happening with me since the last episode when I talked to Andrew Mellon about the stuff behind the stuff. I've had some stuff, the junk, I call it. I've just been feeling kind of gross, although I'm better now as I record this. As of a couple weeks ago, the first day for me of this junk started with instant dizziness when I got out of bed. I walked downstairs and found myself in front of the toilet just pleading desperately to my body to just get it over with and freaking puke. And I found myself slowly lifted off the floor after unsuccessfully puking, but successfully fainting. Ugh, that was a messy day. I spent 29 of the next 37 hours in bed, only crawling out to make sure that Braveheart was still my favorite movie of all time. The good news is it is. All the while, my wife Melinda was a champ, a total champ with the boys until we flipped the script. She got sick, and then it was my turn to be on little dude duty. Melinda has since recovered, thankfully, but ooh, boy, I can't remember either of us, let alone both of us. We overlapped and we're just knocked out. Migraines, zero energy, just bronchitis for her. Ooh, I'm glad we're over that. And now that we have discussed a little of the gross stuff, let's get on to the good stuff. The heart of the show. This episode features Dee Williams, tiny house champ, plus gratitude and humility enthusiast. I'll give you Dee's bona fides in a moment, but this was such a great episode on so many levels. I hope you like some of our chuckles along with our insight, because she and I teamed up to bring you the views of two goofballs goofing off probably more than a few times. I lost count. When we did get serious, and there is a fair amount of that too, Dee explained how farm life prepared her for just about anything. Her moments of awakening and serendipity that led her to build her tiny house. This intense liberation that she has achieved by not having so much stuff, and how to improve your relationship with nature, reclaiming a sense of bigness once again. You ready for this? Here we go. Welcome, Smart and Simple Matters listeners. We're going to have more and more fun today the closer we get to less and less. That's because my guest is Dee Williams, the founder of Portland Alternative Dwellings and the author of the newly published and very popular book, The Big Tiny. Now, knowing Dee, she would never seek out the title of Miss Fancy Pants, especially when she's rocking her overalls. But you should know that she is a big enough deal to be featured in the New York Times, CBS This Morning, and Slate. She is also a pretty published public speaker with a TEDx talk and an absolutely mesmerizing talk she gave at this year's World Domination Summit, which I had the extreme pleasure of seeing live. And I can also tell you from personal experience that her dog, Oli, he's pretty groovy too. Welcome to Smart and Simple Matters, Dee. I'm excited to have you join me.
Hey, cheers, Joel. I'm psyched to be here.
Well, we're going to start where I always start, which is with something I call the seeds of awesomeness. So if you would, could you tell us one to two things about your childhood, maybe an experience or something about your environment growing up that better helps us understand who you are today?
Well, I'll try. I grew up on a farm with a couple of younger brothers and an older sister. There was a lot of acreage and not enough parental supervision. So we ended up having plenty of time to do things like, you know, try to make tridents out of pitchforks. And one time I tried to walk across our, you know, barnyard pond with styrofoam cooler lids strapped to my feet, thinking I could walk on the water that way. And, you know, we got into all kinds of mischief and had many great adventures. And, you know, most importantly, I was outside all the time. You know, we lived, this was in Missouri, the Midwest, and, you know, catching, you know, fireflies and being in creek beds and, you know, being out in the woods was where I felt most comfortable. So that kind of shaped who I've become over time as an environmentalist and as somebody who's passionate about our natural environment, I think. And also why I'm, you know, perfectly capable of making a rope swing out of, you know, extension cords if necessary.
Uh-huh. If necessary. When would that be necessary? Have you had
when there's no rope available, you know, essentially.
All right. Well, I've never had cause to try that particular skill, but I'm open to having an experience. So going along, you leave the farm at some point in time. When did that happen? What did you transition from that farm experience into something else?
Well, you know, in the early 90s, I had just finished college. I was working at a research institute. And I had a job offer out in Washington State to work for their State Department of Ecology. And, man, I grabbed a hold of that and went for it. I couldn't wait to get to a place like Washington where I'd drive an hour west and I'd be at the beach, drive an hour east and I was climbing Mount Rainier or a bunch of other peaks in the Cascade Mountain Range. So, you know, their natural environment, huge old-growth forests and, you know, all of Puget Sound, which is kind of where I live in Olympia, Washington, you know, orca whales and all manner of sea life is at your disposal, as well as this really cool, you know, high mountain range. That's, you know, the Olympic Mountains are there, the Cascade Mountain Range, the Black Hills, all this amazing natural environment. So that was the 90s. That's how I got here.
Uh-huh. And when you got there, in terms of reorienting yourself to a different part of America or to a community that you were unfamiliar with, was it a easy transition or was there something in particular where you just had to readjust your mindset or the way that you engaged people when you got there?
Oh, there were all kinds of shifts. You know, I was used to people being a little more private about their politics. And I remember I had been in Olympia for about maybe a month, and it was some sort of an election season, and it seemed like everybody had some sort of a sign in their front yard broadcasting, you know, who they liked and or who they didn't like. So that sense of adamant quirkiness was something I wasn't used to. And similarly, you know, it seemed like at the coffee shops and stuff like that, people would feel completely comfortable coming in and doing spoken word or playing an instrument really badly. It was just like almost anything could happen, which was really different than a little more straight-laced propriety that I felt growing up in Kansas City, Missouri, and then Kansas City, Kansas.
Yeah, and now I assume based on who you are and what you do these days, which we'll get into a little bit, and the kinds of people that you surround yourself with, you're just completely at ease when other people are completely at ease and open and allow themselves to be vulnerable. Is that true?
Oh, totally. I love goofballs. I love it when people, you know, try something for the first time, and, you know, very rarely does it go well the first time, but I love being in an environment that supports people giving things a go and seeing what happens.
Yeah. Well, speaking of your first time, now that we know a little bit about your seeds of awesomeness, I would love to hear about your seeds of tininess. And I know about a decade ago, you had a journey into a novel idea that, as you say on your website, your life is for living. Can you tell us a little bit about this change, even if you want, going back to your trip to Guatemala, in terms of how you had this, to me, it seems a rather radical shift in terms of your priorities and how you viewed the purpose of life?
Well, I think I was lucky. This was actually about 10 years ago, 11 years ago, right around in there. I took this trip to Guatemala, and while I was there, I was helping to build a school, but more importantly, I just had an opportunity to kind of come face to face with how most of the world really lives. And it's very different to experience poverty, to experience a cycle of civil war and stuff like that, personally, versus kind of reading about it or seeing it on television or watching it in the movie. All of a sudden, you know, I was building relationships with people that live in Guatemala and hearing about their personal experiences. And I came home from that trip. I was living in Portland, Oregon at the time. And I just, you know, didn't really feel like my life fit in quite the same way. You know, my house was big. I had been staying with people that, you know, lived in little tiny houses smaller than my garage. They had like a soup pot and a blanket, and, you know, we're paying huge amounts of money to get their kids to school, paying bribes to get them there safely. And sitting back into my life of walking around the corner to grab a coffee for $3, which was more money than some of these folks made in a week, it just started feeling uncomfortable. And on the heels of that experience, I ended up in the hospital. I had a heart attack. Totally random, totally unexpected. I don't have a family history of heart problems at all, and was diagnosed with congestive heart failure. So, you know, I had this like a little bit of a 1-2 punch, and there were other things going on in my life at that time as well. I had a dear friend who had just been diagnosed with cancer, and he was dying. So it was just like this perfect storm of awakening, sort of waking up and realizing that this is my one perfect, beautiful life, and what did I want to do with it? And so, you know, at the time I was working for the state. I liked my job, but it was hard work, and I was working a lot. And I owned a big, you know, 3-bedroom house, a really normal existence of mortgage and utility bills and, you know, race off to work in order to make money to pay the mortgage and race home and repair, dust, vacuum,
yep.
Repair, dust, vacuum.
Yep, I remember those days very well, too.
Yeah, which wasn't, I don't think I felt unhappy. I just felt that it was a bit of a grind and this is what people do. So it wasn't unhappy, it was unsatisfying, mm-hmm. If that makes sense.
Oh, it makes total sense.
And so, yeah, I was sitting in my doctor's office one day, and I read an article about a guy who had built a little tiny house, I think it was 120 square feet or something, you know, built on a utility trailer. And it looked like this classic kind of, you know, old tiny kind of prairie house, just super cute gabled roof, pointy little roof. Looked like a vacation cabin or little tiny house you might see in a town in Missouri. And all of a sudden I was struck with like this dream, this possibility that maybe I could let go of my bigness and move into something small, and the world would make a little more sense to me. If I simplified, you know, my problems would seem smaller.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny, the psychology behind all of this, but I think I really did just bite into this dream of simplicity and, you know, the notion of things kind of ironing themselves out if I wasn't so in debt
right.
to my house and debt to my job.
So that article that you read, I believe it was by a guy, it was about Jay Schaefer, who I'll link to in the show notes. He's doing a ton of awesome stuff, and you can read all about him online. Okay, you have this realization, you randomly stumble across this article sitting in the doctor's waiting room, and you talked about your friend who was dying of cancer. Your doctors also thought that you were dying, that you would have 1 year, 3 years, 5 years, but you were definitely on the clock in terms of your life. So with that backdrop, how did you make the change? You know, being inspired by reading about Jay Schaefer, and you talked about the debt that you had from your mortgage and otherwise, how did you rebuild your life around this sense of bigness by adding a lot of simplicity to your life?
Well, you know, not very wisely, I'll say that. I mean, my decision to build a little house was based on, you know, I had studied architectural engineering and I had done a bunch of home remodeling projects, so I was comfortable with power tools. So it was actually a very arrogant decision to like, oh, I could build my own house. I can design and build my own house. And, you know, getting into the project, I realized, wow, you know, it's more than intellect that builds a house. It's muscle memory. It's getting up day after day, going to work, coming home, and doing something on the house. And, you know, that's that sense of determination, I think, that came with really wanting to reconstruct my life for as long as I had, really shot me out of that process with great speed, if that makes any sense. So I think I was blessed to kind of have this backdrop of my mortality. It helped me walk around in my flip-flops a little bit differently because, you know, every day I felt like, you know, this is my life. This is what I'm doing today. I'm going to the lumber yard. I'm going to Mr. Plywood, and I'm going to load, you know, 400 pounds of wood onto the top of my little tiny Honda Civic. Godspeed. I hope I survive.
Yeah, you need some serious architectural skills just to pull off that feat in itself, let alone build a house.
Exactly. So I feel like, you know, friends of mine that have been in situations where they've had to contemplate their own mortality, whether it's their own illness or they've been the caretaker of somebody who's gotten sick, or friends of mine that have been in war zones and have had to face mortality in a different way, you know, it reshapes your view of every single day. And I remember sitting at a stoplight one day and just completely bawling. I write about this in my book, you know, just crying my eyes out because the red color of, this is going to sound funny, but the red color of the stoplight was just so incredibly beautiful. And, you know, the idea of civil law where we all, like, stop and go and stop and go as ordered by this beautiful red light, you know, it was so beautiful. It was all so precious to me. And that was replete in my life at the time. I was also trying to build a tiny house. I was amazed by the way my veins curled around my wrist or the way that my friends would just show up unexpected and help me put the roof on my house, or they would bring cold beer by at about 5:01. You know, it was a real gift to be able to see my life with a texture and a depth that I don't think I had really understood before I was diagnosed with congestive heart failure.
Yeah, you've had a lot of support, but there's also a lot of folks. I mean, you were doing this at a time where there weren't any tiny house blogs, or people didn't, this wasn't part of the cultural, people just didn't know what a tiny house was or why you would want to do it. Why you would intentionally decide to limit yourself. And I'm putting limits in bunny quotes because you and I both know that you and other people have experienced a sense of freedom, a sense of bigness as a result of going small. So for the people How did you deal with those folks who thought that you were just totally nutso when you declared and started building your tiny house?
Well, you know, I was lucky. I didn't have many people that, you know, kind of looked me in the eye and said I was nutso. I think people were curious. And I had one friend my friend Lizzie, who was willing to ask me if I was getting rid of all of my stuff and, you know, downsizing out of my big three-bedroom house and rifling through my art and my books and climbing gear and kayaking gear and all of that stuff and letting so much go. And she was the only one that was willing to ask if it was because I thought I was dying. And I was, when she asked me that, I was like shocked. I was like, no, it's because I want to live. It's because I absolutely want to, I want to live. I want to live my life unencumbered by, you know, these things that I feel like I need to pay attention to. I need to, you know, lock up my kayak at night and make sure nobody steals it out of the garage and, you know, hang onto my climbing gear because it reminds me of when I was young and I could, you know, bring my foot up near my ear, which I can't do now. You know, like these parts of myself from a long time ago or possessions that I find valuable that are, you know, keeping me from, you know, taking a swing at life in a different way.
Well, just to give people a little bit of context, when some folks might be thinking, well, how tiny is tiny? And your existing house is 84 square feet. And for our international audience, that's 7.8 square meters. And even getting to actually see at World Domination Summit, when you brought to the closing party your, I think you, do you call it your retirement home?
Yes.
Yeah, your retirement home that you're going to move into, that's 56 square feet or 5.2 right. square meters. Some people might be thinking, well, that's preposterous, even for a single person and a dog to live in there. Like, how could you possibly do that? But you have realized so many benefits from it. Could you, for the uninitiated, could you just explain a little bit whether it's from a cultural or a community perspective or even how in tune with nature you are now? What are some of the benefits that you've gained from not just this new mindset, but your new physical environment that you've created around you?
Well, I mean, just on the logical side of it, I spend a heck of a lot less time cleaning, dusting, you know, fluffing, you know, doing maintaining, all of the things that you do with an apartment or a house that's larger. I mean, that's just on the very surface of it. But, you know, the other part of it is that I have everything that I need to be comfortable day to day. So I've got a place to cook a simple meal. I've got a way to keep my food cold in the summer. I've got a way to keep it from freezing in the winter. I've got, you know, a place to go to the bathroom. I've got services off site, you know, my friends' houses or work or the gym where I can take a shower. I've got enough room to store everything I need. So it's not like I'm living some sort of Spartan, esoteric life. I'm not living like a monk in a cave. I've got a pretty cushy life. And, you know, most of the world lives that way, and they're not necessarily desperately unhappy. I think the flip-flop that needs to happen is that this expectation that, you know, you should have a room for each of your children and that you should have space to have a chef's kitchen when all you ever do is cook a single pot of soup. You know, this we have huge appetites for stuff, never really kind of putting it together that we never use a lot of that stuff.
Right.
You know, that's maybe once or twice a year. So ultimately, you know, emotionally, what that helps me feel is this intense liberation. You know, I mean, I feel a lot less encumbered by my stuff. There isn't as much I need to worry about. I never lock my door. You know, I don't have to worry about people coming in and stealing things. I've got a laptop computer that when I leave, oftentimes I just have it with me. So I don't feel that sense of, you know, attachment that I used to feel. And I didn't downsize with the idea that I would find some sort of liberation. That wasn't my intent, but I've certainly benefited from that. I mean, I feel like much lighter as I'm walking around than I used to. And then I also just have more, I mean, very practically, more time and money to do whatever I want. So as an example, I just got invited to go teach a workshop in Japan in October as a part of this disaster relief. There's still a lot of people in Japan that are homeless from the tsunami in 2011. So I get to spend my time going over there and hanging out and getting to help. And in the past, I couldn't afford to be out of work for long enough to travel to a place like Japan. You know, I needed to pay my mortgage, so that wasn't practical.
Yeah.
Now it is.
Right. Now you don't have a mortgage.
Yeah. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And I guess the other part of it is just that because I live in a small space, I really have had to start to view, like the food co-op, I have to shop every other day or so because I don't have a huge pantry. I don't have a lot of space to store stuff and keep it cold. So for that reason, I shop more often. And that has led to this relationship that I have with our local food co-op that's a couple blocks away. It's like, I want it to just do okay. I don't want them to just be happy. I want them to thrive. You know, I want them to do incredibly well. I want to say thank you to the person who's responsible for bringing fresh produce in. You know, I love them because they are my pantry now.
Yeah.
And you know, the same thing goes with the public library. You know, they're kind of my bookshelf, and I love the librarians that are bringing in amazing, awesome books down there all the time. They're just really great. And our local laundromat where I do my laundry sometimes, you know, it's like, they have these new machines that I just love, and I just am so appreciative of it. And maybe that's the linchpin, Joel. It's like I have this sense of gratitude for all of these things that are a part of my community. You know, the local, there's this Garfield Nature Trail that's a couple blocks from my house, and I, you know, that's kind of my living room in some ways. You know, I just have this intense sense of gratitude and humility for being a part of such an amazing place.
Well, it sounds like you also have a profound sense of belonging, too. You keep mentioning community and feeling like you are part of a community and you're contributing to a community and other people are helping you. There's this generosity that's exchanged back and forth. And that's huge, too. A lot of people, whether they live in the city or outside of the city, they don't know the person behind the counter at their local food co-op. They don't even go to their food co-op. They don't know their neighbors, and they don't understand the public library is an amazing asset. I have one just 3 blocks away from my house, and every time I go in there, I think to myself, this is free? Like, this resource and all of the insight, all of the helpful people in here, like, I get this for free? To me,
I know.
That's just amazing. And so having that sense of community and being an active part of building community, it sounds like has been an amazing byproduct of your decision to go small. And I want to talk about that a little bit more, because you talked about the intent behind going small. And I'd like to for you to just comment a little bit about your intent behind writing your book, The Big Tiny. Why, after all this time of living the kind of lifestyle that you've had, why did you decide to write that book?
This might sound funny, but a little bit of, as a reminder to myself, you know, no matter how you live, I've been incredibly blessed to live this simple life for the last 10 years. It's still easy to get pretty distracted, you know, and get caught up in, for me, you know, I started this company with a friend of mine, Portland Alternative Dwellings, and it's like, oh, we should teach workshops, we should create these resources for people, we should get involved, we should advocate for, you know, new city codes and, you know, redesign and then redesign, you know, trailers that are more energy efficient in the thermal, you know, the way that they connect to the house. And, you know, it's like all of this, a little bit of a distraction from the beauty of life is this dizziness, you know? And so I think in part I wanted to write The Big Tiny because it was a real calling to kind of settle in and examine kind of what my day-to-day was like. and re-exercise that sense of, when I first moved into my house, everything was so new, you know, and such a great experience of adventure and working around, like, as an example, not having running water. And it's, you know, this exercise and trying to figure out, well, how do I take a shower? And what does it look like to try to do dishes? And what does it feel like to get up at 6 o'clock in the morning and the jug is empty, so I got to skip over across the lawn to Rita's house to fill it up? You know, this newness and adventure with it. And then over time, you just develop habits and patterns around that. And I think it's very easy to stop seeing the beauty and the adventure in those very simple things. So writing the book was this, you know, introduction to these really simple, beautiful things that I love about my life in a little house. And it was also a way for me to kind of articulate that, you know, living in a tiny house isn't about a tiny house. It's about community. It's about the relationships that you have with your natural environment, in my case, I'm living behind friends, you know, the relationships I have with them, with the food co-op, the library, the laundromat, like we talked about. It's a sense of bigness that comes along with living small that I wanted to try to articulate, because there were more and more people that were interested in building little houses, but, you know, it's not about a little house. It's not about counting your items and getting down to a certain number. Yeah. It's about expanding how you live your day to day. And that was important for me to try to articulate for myself and to offer to others.
So you're trying to present an alternate view from mainstream culture of what's possible and what kind of life, what kind of sense of largeness you talk about, a freedom you get by living the kind of lifestyle that you do. Is there a specific change, whether it's a mindset shift or maybe even a behavior, that you are trying to get people to adopt who aren't already on board with your way of thinking as a result of reading the book? Like one big thing that you hope just desperately that people will change about themselves as a result of reading The Big Tiny?
Well, I don't know if people are going to change from reading the book, but I think the thing that I have so appreciated about being diagnosed with congestive heart failure and then deciding to move into a little house is the humility that comes with that, the humility that comes with having to ask for help. I think culturally we don't do that very well. We don't feel comfortable asking for help. But we live in a culture where I think people are incredibly kind and willing to offer so very much. You know, they're willing to go work for somebody else, to offer their time and energy to somebody else, to stay up late with their kids. But, you know, we hesitate to ask for stuff. And learning how to do that has helped me understand a deeper sense of gratitude. You know, humility and gratitude, I think, they're kind of entwined. And so I think the thing that I would most hope is that if somebody read my book, or, you know, they were thinking about simplifying their life, is what that allows them to experience in the field of gratitude. Because I think that's where I've done the greatest growth, is in humility and gratitude.
Yeah, what you just said reminded me a little bit of what you told about 2,500 people in your talk at World Domination Summit. I wish I could link to it in the show notes, although a few months from now, you know, we're recording this in August 2014, a few months from now, Chris Guillebeau will have uploaded your talk on Vimeo, on his Vimeo channel, and I would encourage everybody to watch D. Williams, the Strider, take the stage and deliver your message. People will get it once they watch it. I mean, it's phenomenal. But you talked, and I'm paraphrasing here, I'm going off of memory, which is always dicey because people who are regular listeners of the show know that I have a very leaky brain. But you mentioned a couple of things in that talk. You mentioned about how it's just an amazing thing to see your humanity up against nature and how small we are compared to the forces of nature, whether it's rain, unrelenting rain, especially where you live in Olympia, Washington. You're talking about encouraging people to walk part of the day, feeling the ground on your bare feet. A lot of us have forgotten just how nice it is whether you're walking in a patch of grass or whether you're walking on some uneven surface, just to be able to feel the connection, the literal connection with the ground. But one other thing that I wanted you to touch on, and one of the reasons why I was excited to have you on the show, is you also talked about in that World Domination Summit presentation, one of the biggest things that's changed for you is the quality of your relationships and the way that you show up with your friends now, as opposed to, say, your mid-30s. Can you explain that a little bit for us?
You know, if you're running really fast all the time, you know, racing off to work or racing off to pick up your kids or racing here, racing there, I mean, we pack our schedules, and we pack our kids' schedules too anymore. You know, it's very difficult to slow down enough to be able to, you know, kind of tend to your relationships in a different way. Tend to incidental relationships, like the person at the grocery store, the person who's unloading groceries out of their car, your neighbor, you know, even your spouse or your kids. It's difficult to make time to just be there, to just be present. And I think that's something that I hadn't really put much thought into, to be honest, about, you know, ooh, how will my relationships change by living in a little house? And ultimately, what I found is that, you know, I don't need to rush so much. I don't need to wear out my shoes so much. I can take my shoes off, actually, and just lounge around and be able to kind of... Earlier this morning, I was hanging out with my neighbor Emily and her 2-year-old son, and, you know, we were watching him essentially try to detassel every flower in the yard, and it was very fun and very nice to have a moment to chit-chat. And yesterday I spent some time making these compost toilets for an organization in Olympia. So it's like, you know, I already have time. And I think that's the difference, is, you know, the simpler you go with your stuff, the simpler you go with the way you're packing your schedule, the more space you have and flexibility you have to be a good neighbor, to be a good spouse, to be a good friend.
Yeah, just...
And I know that sounds cheesy, but it really is true.
That reminds me a little bit of what Cecile Andrews told me. This is Smart and Simple Matters, episode 55. I'll have a link to it in the show notes. But you mentioned the co-op and the grocery store a couple of times, and she talks about how she intentionally picks the longest line possible in the grocery store and the one where the people look the most interesting so that she can chat them up and she can get to know people. And ever since she mentioned that to me, which was just a couple of months ago, that's what I've done. Instead of trying to assess and look back and forth, ooh, that person is just about done, and I can shave 30 seconds off of my life if I get in the right line, and all this analysis, right, and this internal decision-making, I just pick, there's one woman, and she looks like she's open to a brief chat, so I get in that line now. And I'm not a shy guy. I'll talk to anybody at any point in time.
Yeah.
But being willing to go slow, whether it's in the grocery store line or anywhere else, and having more time to do that, which you've built into your life. You've talked about slowing down a little bit, and one of the themes of this show, other guests have talked about, is a sense of nothingness, meaning they don't need anything to be going on. They're comfortable by themselves in solitude. They're comfortable with their own thoughts, as opposed to being fearful that if I leave myself alone, my crazy brain is going to be going all the time and I'll just be spinning myself in circles. I know that you slow down, but do you ever just come to an absolute complete stop? And what's your method of doing nothing? Do you have a go-to nothing resource for us?
My method of doing nothing is very limited, because I have a monkey brain. I was just talking to my friends, Hugh and Annie, about this yesterday, about how impatient I am. And, you know, it's my wiring. I'm going to be one of those, hopefully if I live long enough, I'll be one of those little old ladies that you see out walking super fast, constantly, through the mall, down the street, always. And it's not my gift to have a lot of time that's like lounging around. But I've been lucky, because I have purposefully, I think, even if unconsciously, you know, put people in my life who have kids, and there is nothing like hanging out with kids to make you rearrange your brain and slow down. You don't have any option around it, really. You know, I find kids absolutely fascinating. Same with nature. You know, it's like I can sit on the beach and watch the waves roll in. It's like suddenly, you know, the ocean rises up and puts a bucket over my head and a marshmallow in each ear, and all of a sudden I can slow down.
Yeah.
You know, so I'm not a good resource for you know, decluttering time, because if given an opportunity, I will, you know, oh, I'll multitask. I'll go out and hoe the garden and at the same time listen to, you know, 5 different TEDx talks on the radio, mm-hmm. you know. So I'm willing to learn, though, and I'm hoping to tie into your podcast now so I can learn how to do that better.
It's interesting that you compare children and nature, because I have 2 small kids. One is an 11-month-old son, Clark. He does whatever the heck he wants. I can't control him in any way other than maybe get him to go to sleep every once in a while. And then my almost 4-year-old son, Grant, he has a defiant streak, which is great. I love it when he exercises that defiant streak to a certain extent. But nature and small children are forces that you often can't control, and that we as humans, for some reason, we feel compelled to control and to discipline and to shape in the way that we want them to. And I've found, this is just recently, because you know, I haven't always felt this way, that when I can detach myself from a specific outcome, and when I can relieve myself of the burden of trying to control things that are pretty uncontrollable, things tend to work out a lot better. In terms of, you were talking about a small boy deflowering all these plants, and Grant does that outside on our front steps. I used to tell him, stop taking the flowers off the petals. But now, go nuts, kid. They're going to grow back. And he is in the moment and having a ton of fun and just endlessly happy. Why not let him take the petals off of 4 or 5 different things? He's appreciating, he's engaged fully in nature and appreciating what's in front of him and throwing all the petals in the air. Yeah, that's a great tie-in between small children and even older children too. I don't have any yet, but I would imagine there's some people who are listening right now who are like, oh, you don't need a 4-year-old to not be able to control your kids. I've got a 16-year-old or a 33-year-old or a 53-year-old kid, and I can't even begin to control them. It's really nice when you don't feel the need to do that anymore. And I constantly struggle with that, and I remind myself to not have to have an outcome in mind and just to go with it.
Yeah, I think you're onto something there. I mean, I do think it's control, and I think that's, it's all tied together with, you know, people want to own their own home. They want to own their own chef's kitchen and their own laundry machine and their own library, you know, their own, perfectly put together entertainment center. You know, because they want to be in control of it. They want to be able to kind of experience and do things on their own timeline. And, there's nothing like having kids or having to go through some sort of massive storm, tornado, hurricane. We have big wind storms out here that will get, 90-mile-an-hour kind of consistent winds. There's nothing like experiencing those things to let you know who's really boss. And it's, We don't have any control over that stuff. And, you know, and I think ultimately that sense of humility that comes with the realization that you're just a player. You're not the bus driver. You're just on the bus. Is really liberating. Mm-hmm. Like all of a sudden you can let go of like, oh, I don't have to know what I'm doing. I don't have to be, you know, perfectly smart and beautiful and have, you know, the perfect body and, you know, the perfect clothes and the perfect house and the perfect mate, the perfect children. Like, nobody's in control of this stuff. I'm just here.
Right.
Trying to do as good as I can.
Beautiful, Dee. Well, hey, I want to ask you one more thing, and you can take this wherever you want it. Is there anything that we didn't talk about that you would like people to know?
I can't think of anything other than I'm so happy to be able to have a chance to talk to you. It was wonderful to meet you. Was that a month ago?
Yeah, it was a little more than a month
ago. And I just have to, again, in front of all of these people who are listening, thank you for showing up early in the morning to help me move my little retirement home. And I had gotten about 2 hours of sleep and was groggy, and I don't think I did a very good job of just, you know, essentially bowing down to you and washing your feet with my hair or something really dramatic as a thank you. So I appreciate having a chance to at least talk with you again, and cheers to you.
Thank you. I'm blushing. Seriously, I am blushing right now. I can feel my cheeks getting rosy and my head getting a little bit warmer. Just for the people who are listening, so in Portland, Oregon, when I was there along with Dee and about 2,500 other amazing people, the closing party, Dee brought her retirement home, as I was mentioning earlier in the show, all 56 square feet of it, and there's a line of about 100 people waiting to take the tour, which you just poke your head in the front door and look around and you think, okay, that's a decent
retirement
home. And there's 100 people waiting to take the tour, and there's one other person just standing and chatting up Dee. And I'm thinking to myself, come on, people, this is Dee Williams here. Talk to this woman. She's amazing. So I was asking Dee, it was 9 o'clock at night, and I said, Dee, I'm in town for another, 12, 14 hours. Is there something I can do to help you or help the local community in some way? Because I'd like to do that. She jokingly said, you want to come back here at 9 o'clock in the morning and help me hitch up my tiny house to my truck? And I said, yeah. That would be a lot of fun. So the next day, Joshua Becker of Becoming Minimalist and I, we took a stroll to the grounds where the closing party was held. And for about half an hour, we had a chat and watched Oli, your dog, run around, and just didn't seem like we helped too much. But it's those little things which people are most appreciative of. And that didn't even seem like much. And it was just as much a gift to me to be able to talk to you more and feel helpful as it was from your perspective in terms of helping you hitch up that tiny house when you were groggy and in need of somebody to lend a little hand.
Groggy and in need of somebody to say, this is the steering wheel. It's on a truck. See? And then you use your right foot, and you can push on an accelerator. It's an amazing thing. Yeah, I needed help that morning.
You know what I need to do?
And Joel, you were the one. You and Joshua were my lifesavers, my little water wings.
He did warn me, just for full disclosure. Joshua is always pulling more of his weight. I'm going to put the picture that I took of you and Oli as you drove away in the show notes this, just so that people can get a sense of who you are and see what it looked like as you left town. Well, Dee, this has been fantastic. I really appreciate you coming on. Is there, for the people who are inspired by your story, whether they read your book or not, is there somewhere that they can find you online and they can know more about PAD, which is your biz that you founded, or anything else that you're up to?
Sure. If they go to www.padtinyhouses.com, so it's padtinyhouses.com, there's a link to my book, The Big Tiny. There's all kinds of other resources. And if they ever happen to be out in Portland, we have these monthly get-togethers. Tonight we have 140 people showing up to hang out and talk tiny, and more than anything else, just chum around. So if you're in Portland, it'd be great to see you.
And even if you're not in Portland and you go to that website, you can check out tour stops. Dee's going to be in Japan, apparently in October, but also all across the U.S. coming up. I am working on getting her to the Minneapolis-St. Paul area, hopefully this winter, and you can catch her in a number of different places. So there's a lot of reasons to go to that website, Dee, but figuring out where you're going to be and where you're building community at the local level as you traverse our great country is also another great reason for people to check it out.
Awesome.
All right. Well, thank you again. Next time, I have a feeling there'll be a follow-up, and you mentioned this at the start of your book. I'm going to ask you about a couple of long-winded things that you usually wouldn't detail when someone asks you sup, and then you can just go wherever you want with it.
Sounds
That's
awesome.
Good stuff. All right, Dee. Take care.
Take care. Thank you so much. Woohoo!
Wow. I hope you enjoyed that rambling, imperfect, smart, and lighthearted chat with Dee Williams. Just being in her presence makes me say, woohoo, over and over again. Here's another one, Dee. Woohoo! I won't forget about her feelings of liberation, that deep sense of belonging in nature and her community, and the intense gratitude or humility that embracing the tiny house lifestyle has brought to her. And who would have thunk that downsizing your space and needs increases your ability to ask for and actually get help. Awesome-o. Remember to show Dee the Smart and Simple Matters love by checking out her Portland Alternative Dwellings website and giving her book, The Big Tiny, a chance. Don't bother looking for her on social media, except on Facebook at Pad Tiny Houses, because she's just not there. You definitely have a better shot of running into her at a food co-op in Olympia, Washington. You can find Dee's website, book, and all the other resources we spoke about in the show notes for this episode at valueofsimple.com/SASM057. On a related note, I was quietly trying to convince Dee to stop by Simple Rev in Minneapolis, Minnesota on October 3rd after her workshop stop in Decorah, Iowa on September 30th. But it is not in the cards, at least not this year. Fortunately, we have about 50 amazing people who will be attending the first ever Simple Rev event. For example, my co-organizer and half of the Simple Life Together Dynamo, a fella named Dan Hayes. Yet, we still have room for a few more folks. So if you want to be among your kind of people for two intense and joyous days of all things simple living, mosey on over to simplerev.com/tickets and pick up your pass to the action while the grooviness is still available. As of publishing this episode on September 8, 2014, there are a handful of tickets left for Deep Connection, fascinating workshops, shaping the future of simple living, and this is probably not underrated, a big ol' hug from yours truly. That last one's optional, of course. Again, that's simplerev.com/tickets for all this and your bragging rights for having spread your influence all over the first ever Simple Rev event. If you want to get a hold of me, send a picture of you giving me a long distance hug to my email, joel@valueofsimple.com. Tweet a high five to Joel Zeslowski. Remind me how much I need a new header pronto for valueofsimple.com on Google+, or use any of the contact information you see on Value of Simple to say, hey, I'm always looking to hear from you, even if it's just a sentence, heck, even if it's just a word, so I can continue to figure out what you want from me and how I can deliver it with a little bit of flair and a big ol' smile. Thanks so much for all your love and support. I love you folks. I love everybody who listens to the show. You're amazing, and you constantly motivate me to do better each time I crank up the microphone. Really, you're what makes this possible. Without you, I've said it before, I'll keep saying it. There is no Smart and Simple Matters. You're not just a statistic. You're not just an email subscriber. You're not just a downloader. You're part of this community, and I value the heck out of you. I know you are an actual human being, and as a human being, I'd love to hear from you. So those comments, questions, concerns, whatever you got, hit me with them. It's now time for your partner in simplifying to sign off again. You've just listened to the Smart and Simple Matters podcast with Joel Zeslowski, creator of All Things Value of Simple.